Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today it might be deadline day, but much like this January window, we won't be talking about any transfers. Thankfully, there's loads of exciting live action to discuss, including Luton. At what point do we stop being surprised? Crystal Palace, or should I say Eze and Elise FC, and Ange Postecoglou continues to get star performances out of his squad players. We'll also talk Liverpool and Chelsea, and joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have the chief correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel, football correspondent for The Sunday Times, Jonathan Northcroft, and a former footballer who once wrote about spending one January kicking a ball against a wall and being chased by dogs in the park as he waited for an eventual move to Northampton. Gregor Robertson, make sure that phone is on silent. You're not going anywhere this time.
Thank you for that, Tom.
So, listen, I didn't even...
You're delving deep into the
archives. I am going deep into the archives. But we've made it. We're into February. We're nearly there. We've just got to get to June. God knows what I'm going to do next season. Anyway, 8 Premier League midweek games so far, chaps, and there's no doubt what the standout result was. Luton 4, Brighton 0. Rob Edwards' side out of the bottom three. We'll come back to the match in more detail in a second, but Martin, I'd wanted to kind of come to that idea of them out of the bottom three, because if they stay up, how big an achievement is that for Luton and Robbie?
If they stay up, he's the manager of the season. I don't care who wins the league.
Really?
Yeah. If what, keeping Luton up?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no greater achievement than that.
He's going to take it away from the departing Jurgen Klopp, wins the Premier League?
Yeah, on this occasion.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's all relative. Look, you can make a case that Pep Guardiola isn't the manager of the year some seasons, because there was somebody that did something in another part of the league that was contextually even greater. Keeping Luton up, Jurgen Klopp would probably acknowledge, keeping Luton up is a feat. You know, Jurgen Klopp's been the manager of Mainz in Germany. He knows exactly what it means to take a small club and to take them to a level that they didn't expect to achieve, and then exceed expectations to keep them there. No one thought Luton would stay up 2 months ago. And I know it needs Everton to be deducted 10 points at the moment, etc. But and I know that it could all end up getting decided in a court of appeal, whether they stay up or not. But nonetheless, Luton were, if not expected to be bottom, expected to be bottom three. It was unthinkable that they could maintain a performance to stay in the Premier League. And Robert has got them in a position where at the moment they could do that. And could do that not playing bad football at all. And can do that whilst completely revitalising Ross Barkley's career, reminding us all what a player he was, whilst doing that whilst having a significant player at the club, captain of the club, suffer a terrible episode of ill health, which could have really pulled the club down and made it quite despairing. It doesn't have to be. People think, oh, it's such an inspiring thing. It doesn't have to be such an inspiring thing. It can also be a negative. At the very least, you lose a player. I think he's done a fabulous job.
Johnny, Martin's right in pointing out the Everton factor, but when you then look at the table above them, they're only 1 point behind Nottingham Forest, who haven't yet had any points deducted from them. They're only 3 points behind Brentford, of course. So even without the points deduction conversation, as a season performance in its own right, 19 points from 21 games for little old Luton is mighty impressive, isn't it?
It's astonishing. I hadn't really thought of him for manager of the year, but Martin's made quite a persuasive argument there. And the thing that strikes me is, if they can stay up, we know that gives you a really good chance of then building a few seasons in the Premier League. And Rob Edwards' management would, you know, it's not just a football club, it's a whole community that he's on the cusp or has a chance of transforming there. If you keep looking in the Premier League from where they've been, give that town Premier League football for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 10 years. I mean, that literally changes people's lives, a community's lives, and it's amazing. You always look at managers in adversity and not just when things are going well. And early in the season when they were getting beatings and difficult days and we were all writing them off, he never changed. You know, his pride in his players, his clarity of what he was trying to do, his positivity, but not daft positivity, but, you know, real kind of realistic positivity was incredible. And he has, you know, he's on top of all the other things that we've talked about. You look at players like Adebayo, you know, he's had, you know, Port Vale or those kind of clubs, a very sort of checkered lower league career, and suddenly he's a
Bognor Regis Town, Slough Town. Yeah,
yeah. Look at him. You know, what has he got? 8-9 goals or something in the Premier League. Across the pitch, Andros Townsend. You know, that's what a clever little signing that was. The goalkeeper was fantastic. What a find that was. It would be certainly one of I'm struggling to think of a better achievement in terms of staying up than this one would be. I can't, off the top of my head, think of a less likely club to stay up.
Blackpool went straight down again. Blackpool had a good go.
They were really good.
But they did go straight back down again, you know. And that would be the nearest comparison, I would think, in terms of a club of the size of Luton, although obviously Blackpool were a much bigger club.
Barnsley stayed up for a year, didn't they?
Barnsley stayed up for a year, they did.
But I think Luton's smaller.
Yeah. Yeah, so do I.
Johnny, just thinking about that kind of community point, because we had Pelly Ruddock and Panzu on the podcast, of course, Luton midfielder. Thinking about some of the things Martin raised as well with the Tom Lockyer situation, I was kind of spotting this week on the editing desk lots of pictures coming out from the club of Tom Lockyer being back at the training ground and all the kind of responses that his teammates were giving him. Rob Edwards has used that kind of, you know, community spirit, hasn't he, that they've had the whole way up under different managers as well. He's really tapped into that with this squad, hasn't he?
He has, and not in a manipulative or cynical way, in a very genuine way. I mean, the man was in tears over Tom Lockyer, and nothing other than genuine feeling that he's got for his players and his community. You know, Pelly, when he was here, was telling us about you know, the porter cabins and the kind of humble training ground and playing in the fifth tier, and each season. I think the thing that stuck out for me was him saying that every single season they finished higher than the last over a 10-year period, I think, except for one season in that whole journey. So there's a backstory to this of a club that, you know, was almost extinct, building ever so slowly, not in a spectacular way, not in a Hollywood Wrexham way, not in a big investment way, but just building step by step to get here. And then, my goodness, taking their chance. And Rob Edwards succeeded Nathan Jones, who was a Luton legend. I mean, that's the other thing. He took on the poison chalice, as it were. And I mean, yeah, what a manager.
Absolutely. Gregor, talking about the performance then, back to this win against Brighton. That first goal, so much is made of Brighton and the way they play and don't come onto them. That's what they want. They're keeping the ball, waiting for you to press and knock it round them. And then Luton, straight from the kickoff, swarm them, get a goal. But you've got a theory as to why it might not just be Luton's bold approach that might have had an influence on this kind of outcome.
No, I mean, just watching it and seeing the... No, it wasn't just that goal either. Seeing several kind of moments in the game, I just think that the surroundings... make it feel different for any opposition coming there. It feels, everything I've played there, it feels so claustrophobic. The crowd feel close to you, the pitch feels smaller. It probably isn't, you know, we could measure it depending on the dimensions aren't, but that's the feeling you have inside the stadium. And when a team is pressing you and it's all over you, and, you know, as a team like Brighton who want to play expansively and they want to, you know, play little triangles in the middle of midfield and stuff, it's just a completely different environment to most Premier League grounds that they're going to. And I feel like that... I feel like the sort of... the Kenilworth Road effect that we spoke about at the start of the season and thought would be a thing that they have to harness if they're going to stay up or have a chance, it didn't happen in the early weeks, and it really is happening now. You know, we've seen when Arsenal went there. We saw... I was at the Chelsea game. Chelsea, Arsenal game. All of them came away either with their kind of noses bloodied or like knowing they've been in a real game. They might have escaped to the points, but they pushed them really close, and all of those teams felt the same thing. They tried to play their football and they weren't really allowed to do it. And that's what Luton have to do, and we knew they would have to do to stand a chance this year. And yeah, look, there's a long way to go, but the other fear for me was always just, you know, I was at the first game of the season too, which was a 4-1 defeat against Brighton, and It was just the kind of the cutting edge in both boxes. They played well in that game. They were in the game until like the 85th minute, I think, until it was kind of put out of sight. and he just wondered where it was going to come from. And Adebayo has stepped up, really has stepped up, and they've found a sort of a structure at the base, structure and defence. As Johnny said, the goalkeeper's been outstanding. Those kind of, if you look at the expected goals and stuff, they're still right down there. There's like, they're giving up chances. They're often not, they're putting sort of cross, a lot of crosses in the box rather than creating clear goal scoring chances, but it's working.
Is it players like Adebayo, Carlton Morris, etc., are they performing above themselves, or is this a kind of trajectory where they're suddenly going, they're Premier League players,
yeah,
do you think?
Yeah, you get the impression they just feel they feel that they can go and compete at this level now, particularly if they're playing their game.
Hmm.
You know, Carlton Morris is a big, strong, powerful guy who, it doesn't matter how good a player you're playing against, those are kind of traits where he will compete against anyone. And Adebayo has, you know, scored some great headers.
Hmm.
So yeah, I just feel like they're probably finding their feet, but they're all they kind of, I don't think you can underestimate Barkley's importance too. Did you see when they took kickoff? I think it was the start of the second half, and he went to dummy to play it back to the goalkeeper, to play it back to a defender. And Brighton started to chase it, and he just dragged it back and cut through the middle of midfield. Like, that's just moments of quality like that that can get them on the front foot. I've transformed them, and then, you know, Townsend didn't play in this, but some of his deliveries too, just the, you know, cutting back on his left foot, back post for Adebayo at the back stick. Just little flashes of quality that they didn't have, which are really transforming their season.
It's a question I've asked before, maybe with this set of people as well. Ross Barkley, still not in England contention?
It's a different one. I mean,
that's a good noise, Johnny.
Once you get, well, I mean, maybe Jordan Henderson's left a vacancy in the squad, should we say. I don't think Southgate will drop Henderson, by the way, but once you get past Declan Rice and Jude Bellingham, I'm not sure there's another central midfielder who's making a really unarguable case to play there.
Another one is one of the very young ones.
Curtis Jones.
Another who's performing well now is Loftus-Cheek.
Who so Southgate likes, of course.
There are a few in a group that could push their way in.
Oh, no, I'm not saying. I
don't see why he shouldn't be one of them.
No, it's just an interesting discussion, isn't it? And it's one we will relate to every single England player for the months to come. Martin, just to talk about Brighton very quickly. Little dip expected, understandable.
Expected eventually. I mean, they sell a lot of players. Mm. And I've always been of the belief you cannot keep selling and keep selling and keep selling without it eventually affecting you. In the end, there will be one player too many sold, or there will be one buy that doesn't work out that you really need to work out because you've sold two players in that position or whatever, and you really need the new guy to work. And, you know, and it gets harder. And that's what's happening. But further to the point you're making here about Kenilworth Road and stuff, it's just interesting because if you imagine Luton at a purpose-built stadium, say 20,000 capacity, one of those IKEA-type stadiums that everyone, just out of town on a dual carriageway,
which we were talking about only last week, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. You couldn't imagine this happening quite the same. There is something to be said for these old English football grounds. And I can remember Jurgen Klopp, when he first came into English football, not being able to get over how many grounds were right in the middle of the city, and that you'd be walking around and you'd be going, oh, I wonder where the football stadium, oh, there it is, oh, look, there's the football stadium, like just right in the centre of town. And he said, and what it means is, when you get to the stadium, he said, sometimes you're looking at the away dressing room and you're thinking, what, really? What, this room? all of us in here? He said, you go to Crystal Palace, he said, there is a post in the middle of the away dressing room at Crystal Palace. He said, you have to sort of peer around it, you know. He said, to sort of look at your players when you're trying to talk to your players, you have to look round this post so that they can see you. But because obviously all the German stadiums are out of town or in lovely big parks and stuff like that. But, you know, there is also something to be said for that Kenilworth Road feel where you're in the middle of the town and the terraced houses, in that case you actually walk through the terraced houses. And it's fantastic, and it must be really different. I mean, Jack Grealish was talking the other day about
Notts County, wasn't it?
Was it Notts County? And they got delayed and had to go there by
bus. They had to go by bus, didn't they?
Bus, and not on the same day or something like that. And he said all of the like the European players, were sort of tearing their hair out. Oh, I haven't been out to eat what exactly what I wanted, and, you know, we haven't been out to have our usual routine or whatever, and we can't do this and we can't do that. And Jack Grealish, who's obviously, you know, been on loan a few places and has come up through the English system, is sitting there going, oh, this is what it's all about, Notts County. This is what it's all about, we're going to Notts County. And it's just very interesting, because there will be players going to Kenilworth Road who haven't actually seen anything like that, really, that have been in these elite divisions all their lives and haven't really, since they've been professional footballers, gone to a place like Kenilworth Road.
Yeah. Just give Luton a quick nod in that I think they appreciate all those things, and that the new stadium is in the city.
Mm.
But the site that they have, in fact, you know, that's where you park now as a journalist, and you have to walk to the ground. It's right in the city, and the way they've had it designed is to make sure that they can be as close, the fans can be as close to the pitch as possible. That the stands are, you know, a little bit steeper than most modern stadia. So they absolutely acknowledge that that's something that they want to hold on to a bit of, because it's part of their sort of history and what makes them Luton.
Yeah, absolutely. From one old great English ground to another, then, and to Selhurst Park, Crystal Palace 3, Sheffield United 2. I wanted to talk about Eberiche Eze and Michael Olise. What a lovely set of footballers they are, eh? You know, Gregor, you've written about them before, you've watched them. Every time I bring them up, you're like, oh, I'll happily speak about those two. Which do you think is the more important player to Palace in terms of what they offer? Didn't prep you for that question, did I?
Yeah.
Just throwing that at you.
I think that's really, really hard. I mean, really hard. Because Eze sort of creates goals out of nothing. Some of his little slalom and runs, and you see the pace he's running at the ball with, but he can still change his angle or drop a shoulder. And, you know, a lot of time he looks like a really languid, elegant footballer, but he can turn the pace and sort of do something quite sort of jarring as well. And he scores more goals. Olise
makes more goals.
Olise has that thing where he cuts in from the right on his left foot and plays a cross that's almost undefendable towards the back post, like really flat trajectory, like just honestly a nightmare for like a fullback or centre half. So I don't know the answer, Tom.
Chaps, anyone want to dive in?
Just quickly, do you think there's something to do with them both coming from the Football League? Because they're both unconventional, isn't it? What you're talking about. Eze does something unexpected. He's not quite what you think he's going to be, and Elise is like that. And I don't know. I think one of the things that makes them both magic to watch and hard to play against is they're just not identical academy footballers. They are they're people put together their own games almost, and they do the unorthodox, and they show there's still such a value for that in the game. But I don't know, Gregor, do you think that's because of where they've come from, or is it just
maybe? I mean, I think they've both got really interesting career paths, and they've both been kind of rejected. I think Eze was rejected by Millwall, and he was like going to get a job at like a Tesco or something, and then got a trial with QPR. And got in, but you could see. I'm not saying you could see why, but you could see that he is because he's unconventional. He maybe, you know, his biggest strength is not the other side of the game, the defensive side and the press and all the stuff that you now have to do. And I'm sure he realised he had to do that. But when you give him the ball and you let him do his stuff, he's an absolute joy to watch.
Eze had a youth career at Arsenal, Fulham, Reading, and Millwall before finally breaking into the QPR seniors team. So again, to your point about all these big clubs that must have looked at him, must have saw something, but then, as you say, gone not quite.
Yeah, well, I know for a fact. I spoke to someone at Millwall for a piece a while back, and they couldn't see what position he would be. And Millwall played a pretty, you know, they were like 4-4-2.
Yeah,
I think Neil Harris was manager then. It's like, this is, I'm not sure you can fit in here. Yeah. And oh God, I'm sure they're pretty upset.
Do we think that's with Eze and then Olise maybe thinking about going forward? This was something we were discussing on the editing desk, where maybe Olise, as a kind of winger who cuts back and provides crosses, is a player that maybe you could see going on to a bigger club, where Eze has that thing of, because he's at Crystal Palace and he's one of their best players, Roy Hodgson can go, you're the boy, you're the man, you know, you're the new Wilfred Zaha in effect. But a bigger club might not necessarily give that to him.
I think he's so good that he could. I think he's like James Maddison, actually. We wondered that when Maddison was at Leicester. I just think Eze's so good that he could take all that unorthodoxy and impose it somewhere else. I watched him at Arsenal a couple of weeks ago when, you know, Palace were nowhere in that game, but he was like a one man crusade to stop this being hammering. He was amazing, and that's bravery. You know, they talk about that different type of bravery, which is getting on the ball when you're up against it. And that was, you know, he was looking for it, getting it, three or four men around him, managing to sort of drive through into space, and there's nobody to play off. But I think he's got the character as well.
In the England squad?
Oh, definitely. No, he's an X-factor player. I'd definitely put him in.
For the Euros?
Yeah, I would, yeah. Yeah.
You're not in
him? He's doing better than Grealish this season.
I just don't know who falls out. But
we'll worry about that later.
I'd love to see him play for England. Yeah, when you were posing that last question, I would say Elise has a higher ceiling.
Mm.
I don't know, like, he's incredible, and something about the way he can create as well as
3 years younger as well, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. There's just something about him. I think he could go right to the top. To be fair, I've said that since when he got move from Reading.
You did.
It's a bargain. And, I think he's a Champions League player. And I think Eze could be as well. I think it'll need the right sort of environment and, right, you know, the right manager. I think Madison's a good parallel.
Martin, your reaction to some of the points the chaps have made?
Yeah, I mean, there's not a defender in the country that would want to play against Eze, at least they two, obviously. But John's point about Eze in England, that is what he brings, what he will bring to any team, is that he will suddenly come on, and the guys that he's up against, the defenders that he's up against, have suddenly got to start thinking in a different way. It's not going to, you know, the threat is no longer going to come at you in a conventional way. Stuff's going to happen that you're not prepared for. And that's a great thing to have. And that's what, Jack Grealish was mentioned there, and that's what Grealish used to bring when he came on. Suddenly you've got a guy that's playing in a completely different way to the guy that's just gone off. And that's what Eze will bring.
Do you think do you agree with Johnny about the Maddison thing? Do you think he kind of needs that kind of 10 role, as lazy as that is as a definition?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, the 10 role as such, he's not really the 10 role that Michel Platini played, is it? I mean, look, I think he could play at a big club. I think Elise certainly could play at a big club. I think Eze could play at a bigger club, should we say. Crystal Palace is a big club. But could play at a bigger club. But I don't, at the same time, just want to see everyone leave and go to the same six clubs. No. It used to drive me mad. You know, when everyone, all anyone ever talked about was Declan Rice. Yeah, was Declan Rice in terms of what he could bring to Manchester United or whatever. And I know my brother used to sit there swearing at the television and stuff like that whenever it was brought up. So I can understand Crystal Palace fans would feel exactly the same. At the same time, do I think he could thrive, in Champions League football or in more elite football? Yes, I do. I think both of those players could thrive there.
Well, we're mentioning James Maddison. We move on to Tottenham. 3-2 winners against Brentford in a thrilling game. Another thrilling game for Ange Postecoglou's side. I wanted to talk about... we'll talk about Tottenham generally in the season and a bit of the fight back. But I wanted to talk about... It was interesting to me looking at this scoreline and the players involved. Brennan Johnson, young player, brought in... You know, who knows how quickly he was going to settle. Richarlison, player who's had difficulties off the pitch and, you know, widely criticised and mocked for his transfer there, now looks pretty important. Timo Werner getting an assist. This is just what Ange Postecoglou seems to do, isn't it? He gets a lot out of players, not even necessarily his stars all the time. Johnny?
Yeah, he does. I think, as well, Johnson was a substitution, wasn't he? He changed it at half-time and threw him on. He does, and how Spurs coped in the period without Maddison was amazing, and how they're coping without Son is pretty amazing. And it's what you say, Tom. It's a manager who has got a sort of collective ethic going on, an ability to inspire players to play above themselves, and I suppose a template where everyone feels they can express themselves. Johnson being a case, looked a bit intimidating when he came, and now you're seeing his sort of true self, I think.
Thinking about the rhythms of the season, do you think it almost helped that they had that little blip earlier in the season, you know, and maybe lost Maddison, lost Van de Ven, you know, rather than kind of steamrolling through, getting through to kind of Christmas, still being right up there. Do you think it maybe helped the team and the squad because it helped Postecoglou bring some of those squad players in?
I mean, I suppose it helped with the hype because it was at a point they were unbeaten, wasn't it? And people were talking about them winning the league, and maybe it wasn't a bad point to...
Still only 8 points off Liverpool.
Well, I mean, I've got a friend who's a sort of coach analyst who worked with Postecoglou at Australia, and I mean, he said to me right from the start, he said, look, there'll be a point where there's a teething problem with Ange Ball because he will not take a backward step. He'll keep going for it. We saw that against Chelsea.
Yeah.
And my friend Chris predicted it. He said it will happen. And the important thing is that everyone understands why it's happened and that he maintains the backing to keep doing his thing. And he's come through that. So I think the important thing was that he came through that. And my God, he came through that, I think, because Spurs fans are just enjoying themselves so much that there was never any pressure on them.
No, absolutely. Martin, looking at them the season as a whole, I've touched on it there. They're still only 8 points off the title. I'm not necessarily saying, oh, they're well in it, they're going to run Liverpool all the way, but they have overtaken Aston Villa, who were beaten by Newcastle. Mm-hmm. Are they back in that kind of driving seat now for this fourth place?
Whether it's the driving seat, but they're certainly back in that scrap for the top four. They're back into Champions League contention and who knows? Liverpool are showing zero signs of giving up 8 points to Tottenham between now and at the end of the season. Let's be honest about that. But I don't think anyone was saying when Ange took over, we'll be very disappointed if we don't win the league in our first season when we've lost Harry Kane and we've got Ange Postecoglou in as the manager. I don't think anyone was setting the bar that high. If the man can get them into the Champions League, he's done a fabulous job.
Yeah.
Done an absolutely fabulous job in his first season because everyone thought, you know, how many times we looked at Tottenham in the last 10 years and gone, well, if you take the centre forward away, they're you know, they're top 10, aren't they? They're top 8 at best or whatever. Take the centre forward away, this team's done. And far from being done, they're in a stronger position than I can remember since Pochettino was there, really, because Conte, Mourinho have got them into good positions before, but not with everyone as excited about the football that they're playing as they are at the moment, whereby if they finish fourth or if they finish fifth, it'll be a disappointment now to finish outside the top four. But people would still look back at that and go, God, didn't we have a good season? Didn't we have a go? You know, weren't we good to watch? So there's a lot to be said for that. You know, I'm a big, big, big proponent of football as amusing the working class. And, you know, this man has added to the gaiety of nations. There is absolutely no doubt about that.
Great. You know?
I mean, yeah, I was looking at...
Try saying something new about Ange Postecoglou not said in the last...
I was looking at the heat map. I was looking at a heat map, just how boring I am, from the game last night. And look at that. It's extraordinary. I know this doesn't translate on the...
It's
like an inverted Christmas tree. Like, the two centre-halves, they must be the highest in the league. They're literally above the halfway line. That's how... That's their average position. In fact, one of them's not centre-half. It's Skip. Well. Skip was deeper than Romero. So Romero's carrying the ball out. And then you've got both fullbacks, Udogi and Pedro Porro, playing like inverted, so like number eights. And then you've got Werner and Kulusevski high and wide. And even Richarlison is like deeper than the fullbacks in their average position.
Gregor was doing something kind of equivalent of the football tactics YMCA as he was explaining that.
But, you know, looking at that, you can see why they're rope at the back. Let's be honest about it. They've conceded 33 goals.
Yeah.
They could have conceded an equaliser quite easily in this
Without
game.
A doubt.
But as Martin's saying, my God, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's been great fun. And, you know, not just for Spurs fans, this is great fun to watch.
They're bold, aren't they? Yeah.
They're bold and they don't take a backward step. So, yeah, Great heat maps too.
Great fun, great heat maps, great dance moves from Gregor Robertson. If you're having great fun with this podcast, you can let us know, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk, or if you've got strong views on Eberiche Eze and Michael Olise, where they might play and who should make the England squad this summer, definitely get in touch as well. Stick with us, we're going to talk about Liverpool and Chelsea next.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Jonathan Northcroft, Martin Samuel and Gregor Robertson. Now, we come to one of the more unusual stories, Johnny, that I think you've done this year, this season, maybe. Sometimes our writers come along with a tale that even I've not heard of and I'm completely shocked by. This was headlined, How Carlos Tevez Became the World's Least Likely Manager. Carlos Tevez is a manager, everyone. I couldn't believe it. Johnny, tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, it just caught my eye that he was a manager in the first place, and then I started looking into how he was doing, and I'll tell you about that, but the answer is extremely well. I mean, yeah, I can't think of a player who, having met during his playing career, I would have thought was less likely to
really
go on and do this. And I started the piece talking about interviewing Carlos at Man City, and it was a visit to a school, one of those community events, and the biggest memory was standing with the sort of City staff outside the school with a head teacher, everyone sort of nervous and punching their phones because it just looked like Carlos wasn't going to arrive. And I think he was about an hour late. This 4x4 comes screaming up. He sort of tells all his wife's driving it. She kind of shoves him out the door, and he kind of, like a naughty schoolboy, sort of runs in. And that was him. You know, there was a kind of rebelliousness about him at City. Famously, fell out with Mancini, refused to warm up actually as a substitute. To stand his ground, ended up sort of going home to Argentina and accepted $9.3 million in fines to kind of prove his point.
Stubborn, some might say.
A bit stubborn, headstrong, but his own man, you know, very much his own man. Came back and did actually play a part in City winning the league, but, you know, never quite patched up, maybe with Mancini, left again. There was an episode in China where he sort of took out one of those enormous Chinese Super League contracts and then decided he didn't fancy it and went back off to Argentina. And the Argentinians kind of celebrated that act. They call that Robin Hood act. You know, he's gone to China, taking the money like Robin Hood, and now he's back with us. And he just... I loved him as a player. Really loved him as a player. Very nice guy, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you then speak to him after that episode of falling out the 4x4, is he then...
He was incredible with the kids. You could see one of those people, just a warm person who the children loved. And when I sat down with him, we did have an interpreter, just open, actually, an open book. I was talking about his family quite a lot, his kids. One of his reasons that he became unhappy at City, actually, was just his wife and kids were back in Argentina, and he missed them, and that contributed. But yeah, no, and I know from, you know, Wayne Rooney and players at United how much they enjoyed him being in the dressing room. I don't think he really spoke to anyone much because he couldn't. And again, I wrote about this because I always thought, and I think a lot of people thought, he didn't learn English because he was, I don't know, lazy or whatever. And he revealed later that no, this was a sort of conscientious objector situation. He didn't, you know, his uncle had fought in the Falklands and become an alcoholic, and he didn't want to learn the language of the oppressors or whatever, which you can make of that what you will, but it shows, again,
he's an opinionated.
There's a guy, there's a proper guy there. So anyway, he's back in Argentina, played a lot of golf, and then a couple of years ago sort of was parachuted into Rosario Central amid a crisis, and did a reasonable job, you know, short-term job, 20 games or whatever, help keep them up, played some young players, but then disappeared again. I felt, you know, there's a political situation.
Wasn't like a player, can manager situation.
No, manager. That was his first coaching job. Came in, as I say, did maybe almost like Shearer to Newcastle sort of thing. Did well enough, but nobody thought he was amazing or anything. Went off to the golf course again. And then a year ago, Independiente, who are maybe the Aston Villa of Argentina, maybe, you know, outside Boca and River, one of the big clubs, had a bit of a basket case. You went through, burned through two coaches, found themselves facing, I mean, there's a very, I won't go into it, but there's a very obscure league system in Argentina, league split into two, and they faced relegation anyway, going into the second half of the season. And out of the blue, Carlos Tevez got in contact with the president and said he fancied the job. And then the board was split because the president thought it was a great idea. The rest of the board, well, you can't give it to Carlos Tevez. It came down to a casting vote, and the president went for Carlos. And then came in, and immediately this team that couldn't win went on, I think, 6 games out of 8 they won with, you know, playing ferocious, pressing football, Tevez-type football, but evolving into actually quite good and structured attacking football. And just he's given these amazing press conferences where he's shown himself, I think, to be not just an intelligent bloke, but a real personality. Got a new contract, and I just checked before we came on, he's won the first 2 games of the season and is top of the league in Argentina now. And I love it. I absolutely love it. Carlos Tevez as a manager, you know, I'd like to see it here, to be honest.
Yeah, we certainly would. Martin, we'll come back to some of the other points in the piece, Johnny. In terms of Tevez the person, he obviously played for West Ham, your club as well. As a player, do you kind of tally with a lot of the things that Johnny said about the man, but also the player as well? Was he a player you enjoyed watching?
Yeah, absolutely. He was. He was a fabulous player. But it often happens like that with managers. Guys that you don't expect. Everyone who played with George Graham will tell you that after the match, you know, when everyone's having a drink, as like in the old days, and everyone's having a pint in the pub or whatever, it was George Graham, if anyone started talking about the game, was the first one to go, oh, put the ball away, come on. Ooh, you know. And this guy became this incredibly focused, very, very disciplinarian manager. He was a bit of a fancy Dan as a player. People forget that when George was a player, everyone thought he was a little bit airy-fairy and would, you know, could have been a bit more at it and committed. And he became this disciplinarian manager, this very obsessed manager who played football in a certain sort of way, had Arsenal's defence training with a rope around their waist so that everyone came out and everyone went back in a perfect line. And he wasn't like that at all. You know, if you think of the teams that, say, Mick McCarthy in his early days produced, that Millwall team that he produced, played cracking football. I saw him play Arsenal off the park in the cup once. I think they ended up getting beaten 2-1 or something like that, and it was an absolute travesty. They were tremendous and knocked it about and everything. And you remember him, Mick, as a player, and you're thinking, this is not really the football we came to expect. So people change, and everyone can grow up, would be the wrong words probably, but everyone can have this sort of epiphany at some stage where you suddenly go, no, this is what you should do. This is how you should be. This is what a footballer should be. And by the sounds of it, Carlos,
you wonder if it's like he sort of recognizes, you know, he recognizes his own flaws.
Yeah, absolutely. And
that's, you know, he knows what a footballer should and shouldn't be. Because he wasn't some of those things, you know.
I mean? Well, I remember, that it's a lower down the league version. An example, what Darrell Clark was saying to the Cheltenham manager, he was a bit of a lad in his time. He said to me early in the season that he felt one of his strengths was, he said, I know all the players' tricks because I pulled every single one myself. You know, when I was a player. And so one thing Tevez has brought in is sort of neuroscience in training.
I was going to ask about this.
He waits till players are sort of, you know, stressed and exhausted after all the running exercise, and then they fire maths problems at them to
Sure.
Sort of brain training, you know.
Incredible.
And then he found out from this that three of his squad actually couldn't add or subtract, because a lot of Argentina's players come from really, really tough backgrounds and low education. And he then brought in a school teacher to have mandatory maths lessons for the squad. And there's a man of the people side
the
to Carlos.
Was pleased he was going to get away with murder on the new contract.
That's exactly what Tevez said. He said, he said, this is the story of Argentinian football, that we take players from the barrios. They get taken advantage of. They can't do their own contracts because people around them are, you know, better educated. And he brought that in. He's known for being really calm and, you know, dignified with referees and the press. And it's
Where he comes from in Argentina, I go to a market on Saturday. One of the lads that works in the in a delicatessen down there is Argentinian. He said the place he comes from, I'm trying to remember, is it
Fort Apache.
he just shook his head and he just went, no. He said, not even, no, not even. You know, basically, you know, you wouldn't go there. I would, you know, not even say, he's from Buenos Aires, you know, you wouldn't go to Fort Apache. You just wouldn't go. It is, you know.
Well,
he's on toast,
he seems to be in the right place now, on and off the pitch. And you can read that piece by Johnny. Search for Johnny's name and Carlos Tevez on Google, and it'll pop up. And then you might have to get yourself a Times subscription. You never know. Well worth it. Coming back to the Premier League, chaps. Liverpool 4, Chelsea 1, and probably the quickest rise up the ranks in terms of conversations for a player maybe I've known ever in my career, Conor Bradley. A couple of weeks ago, this kid's quite good, isn't he? He'll be all right. Then a week later, it's like, bloody hell, he's really good. And now he's got Trent Alexander-Arnold's place on toast, hasn't he?
I'm not, you know, you can't be clever after that. But I must admit, I'm not going to claim I was across him, because I had to look up, you know, his background and stuff like that, and the, you know, 13 senior appearances for Northern Ireland that he'd already made had sort of passed me by, I must admit. Mm. But that, you know, the 10-15 minute cameo against Arsenal, you looked at and thought, this kid's a proper player. This is a really good, you know, it doesn't always hit you for, you know, we can all sit there and go, oh, well, the first time I saw Wayne Rooney, you go, the first time everyone saw Wayne Rooney, you knew. But sometimes, young kid coming on, playing at right back, is not the most obvious spot. But it was 15 minutes in that, is it a cup match against Arsenal? Mm. Aren't you?
Yes, well, that was one of the ones I was referring to, where we were discussing, pretty good, this guy.
And just thought, no, he's exceptional. And you just looked at him straight away and thought, well, this is the kid that puts Alexander-Arnold into midfield, basically. You know, or this is the kid that goes into midfield and allows Alexander-Arnold to stay at right back, whichever way you want to play it, really. But, he was exceptional. From the minute you saw him, you just looked at it. So last night, it was a surprise, but it wasn't a surprise, because the moment you saw him, you thought, This is a player.
It's an interesting one to consider in light of the news about Jurgen Klopp's departure, Johnny, and the idea that maybe this isn't the kind of baptism of fire job that some managers get when they take over from a big character like Klopp, because of players like Conor Bradley. You'd look at this and go, I get to mould and work with these guys, and Klopp is leaving. He'll be leaving behind quite a talented squad, won't he?
Yeah, I mean, Martin wrote a column about this, and he's right. There's always a context to it. Replacing Alex Ferguson was difficult, but it's partly because United had reached the end of a cycle. Mm. You know, I mean, there's a difficulty of filling someone's shoes in terms of character, but if we just boil it down to football, that was the end of a cycle. You could say that Wenger's Arsenal, that Wenger left the club in a place where they needed refresh, the squad needed a revamp. Mm. But you wouldn't, to Martin's point that you were writing about, definitely wouldn't say that about Liverpool. It's not a perfect squad, but my goodness, it's a squad on the up. It's just been regenerated by some great transfers. And then it's got these youngsters coming through. And it'd be extremely exciting to inherit all of these guys. I mean, Bradley's, he could be anything, couldn't he? He could be absolutely anything.
His ball down the line in the first 5 minutes, he was running at real pace. Yeah. And it's the kind of thing where he so easily, like, he just opened his foot up and curled it over... Mm-hmm. over in behind the back line for Darwin Nunez to run on. That looked like a Trent Alexander-Arnold pass.
It's almost like
you know, I know how hard a ball that is to play. I've tried it many times and failed, like particularly at pace, and he just made it look so easy. And he's a great athlete, like the way he just accelerated away from Raheem Sterling as well, shifted it to the side, and the finish was brilliant. He made me sit up a few times last night off the sofa, which is no mean feat after like putting the 2-year-old to bed. Your eyes widen a bit, you're like, he's really good.
In terms of inheriting this squad, coming back to it, it's something we discussed obviously on Monday's show, Johnny and Martin. Are you both in the Xabi Alonso camp?
No, not necessarily, and that's no,
yes,
that's no what slight
I like about it. Xabi. We had too much Xabi.
I'll keep my mouth shut.
only that I think let's just wait and see with Xabi. Mm. The guy, the hallmarks are there that he's going to be an absolutely sensational coach, and the job he's done at Leverkusen is amazing. But he's at the start of his management career, and he's 20 games in, and it just might be that this isn't the time for him to do Liverpool. I don't know. And we'll find out a lot more, actually. He's at the business end of the season now, and he stumbled at the weekend. So we'll find out a bit more now about whether he can do that side of it, because there's the two sides of management. And we talked about Ange earlier on. There's a bit when it's going well, and there's a bit when you have setbacks, and you've got to show a different side. And no doubt he's going to be talented. I mean, I think Liverpool have got to look dispassionately, and I know they will, and they'll use rationality and data and all that kind of stuff. This isn't going to happen, but of all the managers out there, I think Postecoglou's the most natural. Who is like Klopp? Who would play that football? Who would have the personality to connect with a crowd? I don't think he'll leave Spurs.
He is a Liverpool fan.
I'm almost certain he wouldn't leave Spurs, and I don't mean to upset Spurs fans. But if you're asking what should Liverpool do, I think they might at least ask the question.
Martin?
I can totally see that. I'm in the Xabi Alonso camp, and I take everything John said on board. I totally agree with that. He's very new. There would be a gamble of some sorts. He's certainly not where Jurgen Klopp was. He's certainly not at the same stage of his career as Jurgen was when he went to Liverpool. He would be a very young, very raw manager. I just think the one thing that would be hard to replicate at Liverpool, I think the team is there. And I wouldn't even be that worried about losing one of the big two. Obviously, in an ideal world, Salah's up front and Van Dijk's at the back. In an ideal world. But if one of them wasn't there, what that does free up in these days of profit and sustainability is money to put a bit of your own mark on the team, to bring, you know, because no manager wants to go, right, well, you know, my starting 11 is exactly the same as the last bloke starting 11 and, you know, nothing's changed. Everyone wants to add a little bit of their own personality to the team, and that would free up the opportunity to do that. So the team is not anything that I'm worried about, and I look at the other managers around, the experience of Postecoglou notwithstanding, and I think Xabi Alonso looks a really good young manager, and we've got to see how the rest of the season pans out. Where I think he's significant is the hardest thing to replace, the hardest thing to replicate, is Klopp's relationship with the supporters. You've only got to see the end of matches at Anfield, and you know, it's very similar to what he did at Borussia Dortmund. Mm. Really, it's not like he's come up with some
and Mainz.
Yeah, it's not like he's come up with something new and totally different. But it is absolutely a guy that understands the club. They love him. He loves them. He loves everything about them. When I went to interview him all those years ago, loves the colours, loves everything. You know, the first thing he fell in love with was the red, and who couldn't fall in love with a team that just plays completely in red? It's just a fantastic strip and stuff like that. So, you know, that's the thing that other managers have found hard. Roy Hodgson never recovered from saying that he held no grudges against Manchester United. You know, that, you know, he never recovered from that, and that he really liked Sir Alex Ferguson. And you know, the people that it hasn't worked for in the past, there invariably the disconnect has been with the place as much as anything else. And that's where I think local hero Xabi Alonso comes in. Everyone loves him straight away. Banners all over the place. And you've got a bit of a chance there. And because if you just try and get someone who's going to go to the Klopp and punch the air, it's just going to look phony. So he doesn't have to do that because he's Xabi Alonso. So he's already the hero. He doesn't have to make himself the hero in front of the Klopp, in front of the cop. He's already the hero.
Yeah. Well, before all that happens, we've got the rest of this season to sort out. Liverpool, top of the table, 5 points clear of Manchester City, who do have a game in hand, and beat Burnley last night. Liverpool have got the big one this weekend against Arsenal. I've got a slight feeling they might steamroll the Mikel Arteta side. I don't know why. And I'm going early with a prediction there. I'm just throwing something out there.
Joe
so you
Cole
don't
thought fancy Chelsea last night.
Yeah.
Mate, you're not meant to use the going room before.
But does anyone see this game? You know, this was a big game before Christmas. We talked about, Johnny, you've talked about being there and what a great tussle it was. It feels slightly like Liverpool have kicked on since that match. And then, of course, they played each other in the Cup as well. Feels slightly like Liverpool have kicked on, whereas Arsenal is still, you know, not quite in top gear.
Yeah, it does. Arsenal have had a good couple of games and getting back there a little bit, but I agree that Liverpool are in, what a moment, you know. I mean, they destroyed Chelsea, and the way they're playing, if they continue that level of performance, only Man City could live with them, and I think it's shaping up to be between those two. So that's not the most original thing to say, I know, but all the signs are that these two great teams are coming at the boil.
Yeah. Martin, would you agree? Do you think it's the onus is on Arsenal to try and almost, even though they're at home, stop Liverpool, stop this kind of juggernaut that's running?
I don't think they'll see it as we've got to stop Liverpool. I think they'll see it as an opportunity to muscle their way back in, right into the middle of it again, which if they were to beat Liverpool, that's where they would be. You'd have got your elbows out and got yourself back involved again. I think it's a very important game for Arsenal in that respect, because if they don't, if they do get steamrolled by Liverpool, they don't even have to get steamrolled really, do they? They just have to get beat by Liverpool, and then suddenly you're looking at a two-horse race, which, by the way, that's another reason why it's not the impossible job, because Liverpool's biggest issue during Klopp's era has been Manchester City. And there, in the next year, we are going to find out what happens to Manchester City for the next few years, you know, which could include, we don't know, which could include a demotion, it could include something that brings the Pep Guardiola era to an end, with it perhaps the Erling Haaland, Kevin De Bruyne era as well, depending on what happens about the 115 charges. So whoever succeeds Klopp might actually find the way forward a lot clearer than it has been the Jurgen Klopp, because that's the team you've got to beat, and it's a lot easier to beat them if they're in the Championship.
Yeah, that's an interesting prospect to consider. But Gregor, I'm going to finish with you. Know how much you love a prediction, so I'll let you go last. We've all had ours. Do you see Arsenal being able to stop Liverpool?
Arsenal could absolutely conceivably win this game. Like,
they could, but do you think they will?
Look, I agree Liverpool are in a great moment, as everyone, that's the word, that's the lexicon there, isn't it?
We're in a great moment.
But, you know, Jota is like making Nunes' sort of, you know, love of the post not matter, because his finishing is outstanding. Going forward, they're just thrilling. They're thrilling. I think when they're tested against better opposition going that way, I've still got some doubts. Like, Joe Gomez is playing brilliantly at left back just now, but consistency has been an issue for him. They're still playing a 20-year-old at right back, or Trent, who himself has issues defensively. Whoever's playing alongside Van Dijk's in imperious form, I've had issues with consistency. I don't think we should get carried away with Liverpool quite yet.
Excellent. And spoken like a man who's writing a piece about Arsenal and how good they are at maybe scoring goals from set pieces, which you can check out on the Times website this weekend. Chaps, thank you very much for joining me. That was a wonderful moment for 60 minutes, I thought. We really enjoyed ourselves.
That's one of the things that foreign coaches have introduced. It came from foreign coaches, that. Yeah. And so we're now getting taught our own language by foreign coaches. No one said that it was a wonderful moment in the English language until you know Jose turned up and Rafa turned up.
Well, we all thought it now. And if you thought it's been a wonderful moment joining us, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. And if you didn't think so, if you think we've missed something out and want us to talk about it next time...
This has been the Telegraph podcast. You can get in touch with him.
He doesn't mean that. But thank you very much for joining us, Martin Samuel, Johnny Northcroft and Gregor Robson. Thank you too for listening. As I say, we'll be back on Monday and I'm sure we'll be talking about Liverpool v Arsenal.